Welcome back to another episode of Chasing the Apex. I'm your host, Sid Sudhir, and today I am sitting down with IndyCar driver David Malukas. David is currently competing in his first season of IndyCar with Dale Coyne Racing. He started out his career in the UAE and ADAC F4 championships before moving to the road to Indy. In the ladder system, he was able to move up the ranks before spending a few seasons in the Indy Lights series with a runner-up finish in 2021. So far this season, David has got off to a great start with two Fast 6 qualifications and a finish inside the top 10 at Mid-Ohio. Stay tuned to learn more about David's story and his goals for the future. Welcome to the show, David. I'm glad to be back and glad that you were able to take the time to come on in between two busy race weekends. So, to start off our discussion today, how do you feel about your first season in the NTT IndyCar Series thus far?
I think it's been good. You know, at the start, it was definitely, you can call me a rookie. I definitely made some stupid mistakes, and every race was a big learning curve. But, you know, since I'd say the month of May, I feel like we've kind of flipped the switch and have been very consistent and kind of had this momentum with the team and have been getting more consistent results. And now I think we're within 4 points of Lungard in the rookie championship. So, no, I'm honestly, the season has gone better than I was expecting.
Nice. Well, you know, as you've mentioned, second in the rookie standing, you've been one of the more impressive rookies in the field this season. But one thing that's really stood out to me, especially in the summer, is your pace with the street circuits. Detroit and Toronto were two qualifying sessions where you made the Fast 6. How have you been able to find the extra pace for those street circuits?
Well, you know, both in Detroit and Toronto, when we unloaded and went into practice one, we in both practices, we were kind of, I'd say, about like 18th, 17th quickest. And then, you know, with the two practices and going into the qualifying, I think the team and I have done a really good job of knowing what I want from the car and, you know, what they need from me. And, you know, we with the car that we unload with, it's from Grosjean's car that because obviously he was with Dale Coyne last year, but I like something that's a bit different. It's not very close to his. It's more kind of what I'm used to in Indy Lights with the car just sliding everywhere. That's, you know, what I'm used to. So I'm like, hey, this car's great, but can we just make it feel like an Indy Lights car? So that's kind of what we've been trying to achieve. And it's been very successful. And we managed to find that setup going to the Detroit qualifying. And since all the street circuit chassis setups that we have are all very similar. So that kind of success from Detroit has carried on into Toronto, and having such a great car, I have all that confidence to push 110% and, you know, get this close to the wall, but I know the car is going to be able to hold on. So then we can get a good lap time in.
Yeah. No, it's interesting you bring up the lights car comparison, because I think throughout the lower categories, I think they're, you know, talking to drivers, what are like the two cars that really stand out that people really love to drive are like the Euro Formula car and the Indy Lights car. So to me, that's interesting that you're actually telling that to your engineers, like, hey, I want to make this feel like an Indy Lights car.
Yeah, well, you know, I was in there for 2 years, and well, realistically 3 years if you count the year that we got canceled, because we still did a lot of testing for it. But yeah, I got so used to it, and it's such a special car in the way it reacts and the way it drives. I mean, for that thing to be quick, it literally just, as soon as you turn into a corner, you got to just counter steer throughout the rest of it. And that's how it's going to be quick. So any sort of understeer, I end up getting a little bit thrown off. And so, yeah, that's kind of what we got the setup towards. And it's been very successful.
And would you say that there's something about the street courses that maybe just might suit your driving style a little bit better? Because obviously in IndyCar, a lot of these streets we're going to, I think Toronto is a great example where it was genuinely like a rough and bumpy surface, like, you know, a regular street. Right, and that kind of changes what is your reference points that you're using for entry speed versus exit speed, braking points, things like that. A lot of that changes. So do you think it just somehow naturally suits your driving style better?
Yeah, it could be. You know, I mean, yeah, it would make sense. You know, both Detroit and Toronto, both street circuits that we've gone to, it's been the more successful out of the other courses that we've gone to. But, you know, I think, I could say that maybe, but you know, Mid-Ohio, we were very close to making Fast 6 again, but we ended up getting blocked by Pato, so we lost our good lap, so we still managed to qualify 8th there. So I think it's a bit of play here and there on, yeah, maybe it suits the street circuits, but I think it's just the team has done a good job on getting the car to where it needs to be.
Gotcha. So for our listeners who don't know, David is technically competing this season under Dale Coyne Racing with HMD. while his teammate Takuma Sato is competing under Dale Coyne Racing with Rick Ware Racing. So David, how does this difference in partnerships affect your relationship with the other half of the garage? Are the engineers still sharing data between cars? Did you bring your own set of engineers to the team through HMD?
So no, HMD Motorsports from the Indy Lights side, all of them have stayed. The only person that has come through with me to IndyCar has been my coach slash therapist. You know, Luke Varley has kind of been my go-to guy. You know, when things get rough, he keeps my mental state good, and also is just a very good coach. He's driven in his past, and he was very good. So he's a good mentor on giving me tips and trying to stay calm. But you know, although I'm with HMD Motorsports and Takuma's with Rick Ware, it's the team is still combined. I mean, when we go into the engineering room, you know, we kind of have our own split desks, and we talk with our own engineers and figure it out. And then once we have our own general idea of what we want to do, we all obviously all turn to each other and discuss and combine our setup ideas. And that's honestly how you can get so much time found within the practice sessions. You know, there's only two practice sessions, and if you have another car, you can obviously try different setups and go different ways. And now that me and Takuma, we trust each other, going later into the season, we've been trying different things with each other. And, you know, if he thinks something that was really good, I trust his judgment and we put it on our car, and also vice versa. And then we're able to get a car that will make the fast six and qualify.
And would you say you kind of become like an understudy to Takuma, or at least felt like you've been asking a lot of questions to him? Because, you know, you have this guy who's won two Indy 500s, obviously a very like hugely experienced driver. So have you kind of like leaned against your teammate a lot this season?
Definitely, especially in the early stages. You know, no matter what race we went to, I was always asking him questions, mainly just for race things and strategy and pit stops. But the most questions was, of course, the month of May with the Indy 500 and any oval we go to, realistically, I always ask him, because he has a lot of tips, but he still keeps some things to himself. He doesn't tell me everything, which is fine. I understand. But, you know, he's been extremely helpful this season.
Gotcha. And the 500 in particular, obviously, it's this big, larger than life sort of event, right? And there's a lot more fanfare, practice sessions, qualifying, like carb day, all these things you have to do, right? So approaching that for the first time, was that a very like intimidating thing to kind of come across, or how did you handle that?
Yeah, let's just say it was nerve-wracking. I mean, qualifying day was already like, you know, just the anticipation of going, and instead of being three laps, it's four laps, and they're just a very long four laps, and you're just, you know, it's a lot going on. And so, yeah, qualifying was very stressful, but it wasn't until race day when you're walking down Gasoline Alley and you just see the amount of fans there. It was an experience I've never felt before. I mean, it was, yeah, my heart kind of like dropped to the floor. I was like, wow, okay, this is intense. And I remember at that time, I actually was standing next to the New Guard, and I asked him, I was like, do you ever get used to this? And he goes, no, you'll never get used to this one. This is the only one you'll never get used to.
Yeah. So just to go back to HMD a little bit, right? How did the idea to start HMD Racing start? Your dad, of course, is a successful businessman in his own right who founded HMD Trucking, but why take that next step of starting his own race team?
So since my dream as a kid has always been becoming, you know, a race car driver, my dad's dream while he was a kid also wanted to become a race car driver, but because he was born in the Soviet Union, he never had the opportunity to, you know, reach out and do those things. So once he got older and obviously at the trucking company, me and him, we fell in love with IndyCar, and his old goal was to have a team in IndyCar, or just in the Road to Indy series. And so that's kind of what came up with Indy Lights. But I mean, before we kind of started with like a 50-50 split with BN Racing, and then with BN Racing went through USF, Indy Pro, and then in Indy Lights, we transitioned to HMD Motorsports. And we ended up bringing on a lot of people from many different places, but mainly a lot of people that have been in the Road to Indy series and understand a lot from Indy Lights. And, you know, within just a flick of a switch, it was 1 year, and the team ended up being very successful.
Yeah, so, you know, HMD this year especially still has a good affiliation with the Light series. I think, was it running five or six cars this year, right? I know that's recently changed with Kiffin Simpson and those guys. But now that you've kind of moved on to IndyCar, is that kind of a focus for HMD, maybe to take that next step, you know, up a rung in the ladder then?
Yeah, I think the whole team is very interested to go into some sort of step in IndyCar, which we've already have with getting that connection with Dale Coyne, and we're also looking into expanding into that scenario. But yeah, no, I mean, any opportunity we can get HMD into IndyCar obviously would be a dream of everybody's within there. It's just IndyCar is a big step, and it's just a lot more money, so it's a lot of work, but I think everything's looking very good, and it's going in good directions.
So then personally, obviously with your connection with HMD, then if in, if HMD does get to the point where they're running like a full IndyCar team independently, would you never ever be racing for another team other than HMD since it's your dad's team?
Well, that would be insane if HMD ever gets to its own independent stage. That would be very, very impressive. Yeah, I don't know. I really, because the way we look at it is, HMD Motorsports is HMD Motorsports, and I am my own independent driver. So I don't know. I think it would be quite funny to be in another team and competing against my dad. But who knows? I don't know. We'll see. It depends with the way things go.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I ask is just because, you see with other with like rookie drivers, I think like Kyle Kirkwood, right, is already signed from Ford to go to Andretti next year and things like that, right? So I think it's like almost as soon as you come in, I mean, obviously there's kind of a pecking order of teams in IndyCar, right? So it's interesting to see where people kind of go from there. And I thought with you in particular, you kind of have like a unique situation, right, compared to some of the other rookies. But to kind of like rewind in your career a little bit, you started off your career in cars by racing in the ADAC and UAE F4 championships. So initially, were you kind of thinking like, oh, racing in Europe F1, that might be a cool route, or and that was kind of why you decided to compete in those series?
No, actually, our whole goal was to come back to the US and do the Road to Indy series. But coming from out of go-karts and going into open wheel racing, our whole strategy was let's just go to different places of the world and learn how to drive open wheel cars away from our actual goal and where we want to be, which is the US and the Road to Indy series. So we started with the F4 in the UAE, the Middle Eastern series, and then we went to the ADAC in Germany for F4. And then after that, that's when we decided to create the BN Racing and go to USF 2000. And so the whole plan was that I learn how open wheel cars drive and I can figure it out. And then by the time I come there, I'm close to being ready to just quickly go up the ranks. That was kind of the whole goal.
So when you say kind of like learning overseas, so was the idea that it would maybe be like a little lower pressure, kind of like away from the eyes of people who might want to critique and things like that, or?
In some way, just to kind of just go be stupid overseas and just do stupid things over here, so nobody really just knows about us. Then when I come back, I can just maybe do a good showing, and then everybody's like, "Oh, where'd this kid come from? He's doing pretty good, like all the
Yeah,
time."
gotcha.
So
And
that was the goal.
so. Would you say going from F4 to USF 2000 was a pretty smooth transition then?
Yeah, well, it was, yeah, I'd say smooth transition from my end, but for the team's end, it was a bit tough because we joined in like mid-season USF, and there was a lot of things to get the team ready to get into the next weekend, which all these other teams obviously had years of experience and we've already done the full season, and we kind of just joined straight in the middle. So it was a bit chaotic from that standpoint.
Yeah. So, as you're saying, right, after doing that year, did USF 2000 really were just started working your way up the ladder. But in 2020, COVID-19 kind of threw a wrench in that progress when the Indy Lights season was canceled. I've come to learn that for a driver, momentum is everything. So, how desperate were you to make sure that you could keep in practice? And how did the Formula Regional America Series help you do that?
Oh boy, yeah. So when they canceled Indy Lights, it was kind of like a 2 week notice before any other racing series was going to start. And so we were looking, and within 2 weeks, we decided to do the FR car, get it, put our like a, just a random setup on it because we've never even used this car before, and then just show up to Mid-Ohio first race. And then we ended up qualifying second with like a thousandth off of Linus, which was very impressive from the team standpoint. It was very good that we managed to actually get into that series before it started and did a full season, because if I just had a full season of just no driving, I definitely would be Yeah, definitely a bit nerve-wracking going into a 2021 Indy Lights season. I would definitely feel more like, do I still, a 1 year off, it's quite a bit, and track time is anything. Even though it's in a different car, as long as it's similar, it will make a big impact. But looking at another standpoint, being through my teen years, I actually really liked, I mean, yes, COVID was very bad, but having that cancellation of that season, I think let me mature that much more, so that when I came into 2021, I felt much more prepared than I would have if I had done Indy Lights in 2020.
And so what you're saying, if you go look at the results on paper, what you're saying matches up with the results, right? You know, that next season in full season in Indy Lights was much better, right? Or so how would you say that for you, just mentally you came in better prepared, or was it more you had actually picked up some more driver skills and were like confident in like the physical skill aspect of your driving as well?
Yeah, I'd say it's a mix of both, just maturity on making better decisions on track and just having that much more knowledge with reaching the maximum limit of the car without, tipping that over. Because that's really realistically the whole goal with any car you really go into.
Yeah, and how much of an adjustment was it to go to like an FR car versus an Indy Lights car?
It was pretty big, because Indy Lights, like I said, loves to slide around and be a loose goose, and that's how it likes to be quick. When the FR car was very much on the understeer, and it really just would kind of be more of a understeer to just a full flat out coming out of corners. It was very, very different. With the team, we tried to make it oversteer as much as we could, but throughout the full season, we still couldn't really get there to where we wanted it, but. Anyways, our whole goal was Indy Lights. So, I mean, it was a smooth transition. It was just, a bit unfortunate that the cars weren't similar to each other.
And like speed wise, in terms of the G's you're pulling, that sort of stuff, is it comparable to an F3 car, or how would you describe that?
Indy Lights is definitely a lot more in every aspect compared to FR. Yeah, I mean, and so in the FR, I'd say it's more resemblance to when I drove F4 in Germany. I'd say it's a kind of closer towards the F4 end than Indy Lights. I feel like Indy Lights is more over here when FR, I'd say, is closer to the F4. Like Indy Lights is a pretty big jump.
Pretty big jump. Gotcha. And I'm assuming that there were other Indy Lights drivers who kind of followed the same path as you that you're coming into FR, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Linus was in the FR season. He dominated that with Global Racing, and then came into the Indy Lights season afterwards as well.
So was that kind of like a weird thing then that like you would perceive that, you know, FR maybe isn't as competitive as Indy Lights? But because of that situation, even though maybe you're driving slower cars, not as great cars as the Indy Lights cars, you actually still had good driver competition in that sense.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, FR. Yeah, no, there was me and Linus had many battles. And also there's other drivers as well there. And it was always a good fun to get to the front end. And I remember there's many different issues, and it was a good season. And overall, yeah, it was, let's just say it helped a lot going into Indy Lights that we had all that racing and I could build up my skill even more.
Gotcha. So transitioning back to your current situation, I've heard a few drivers describe the current IndyCar as heavy, very physically taxing machines to drive. So how would you describe the experience of being behind the wheel of an IndyCar?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of hit that on the spot. It is it's a heavy beast. It is it's heavy. I'd say that the general feeling of an Indy car when just going through a corner, you brake, you turn in, it feels a little bit loose on entry, and then it just goes to an understeer mid to exit. That is kind of the general feeling of an Indy car. I think no matter what driver you'll ask, they'll always say the same thing, that yeah, that's kind of the general feeling of what it is. And with the races being so long and the steering being so heavy, and tracks like Toronto where it's so bumpy and your hands keep sliding up and down on the wheel, and I mean, there's many times why I ended up getting blisters, but thankfully Toronto is finally the first street course that I survived without any blisters.
You know, I don't think I've ever heard a driver like as concisely explain as you just did right now about like what the bounce kind of coming through a corner driving an Indy car. So, either the past drivers I've had in my podcast weren't telling me the truth, or you're just a lot better at summarizing it.
Well, yeah, if you in the future you can give them that example and tell them if that is what kind of what it is. And I'm pretty sure they'll tell you like, yeah, that's kind of spot on.
Yeah. I mean, so the other IndyCar driver that we've had on the podcast, Callum Ilott. So he came from F2, obviously, into IndyCar. And I think kind of like the surprising thing that he was explaining to me was that he actually felt that driving an IndyCar was more physical than an F2 car. So since he's come here to like Indianapolis, he started working out and training more for IndyCar than he was for Formula 2. So did you also kind of similarly feel that coming up from lights, you kind of had to step up your training regimen?
Oh, definitely. So thankfully we had the barber test, right after the Indy Lights season. And so I did that barber test. At Barber is a very tough track, one of the toughest tracks, I guess, in the calendar. And yeah, let's just say after that day, I remember I got out the car and kind of just plopped on the floor. Like I was exhausted. I mean, I'll never forget. I was like, oh my God. Like after that, that test, I counted how many days I had until St. Pete to get as ready as I possibly can be before the races come, because it was a tough day.
And so in terms of training then, what were maybe some of your focuses? Like, for example, I know, the lack of power steering is a big deal for a lot of drivers, right? So it's training your upper body, the neck. Were you pulling more G's, or did you just need to improve your cardio? Like, what were the sort of areas that you needed to work on?
It was kind of a mix of it. The cardio aspect was there because these races were longer races than I've ever done before. Having it's kind of like the steering wheel is almost like these 10-pound dumbbells that you're just moving back and forth for, 2.5 hours. So for that amount of time, it gets up being quite a bit. But a lot of things, especially for ovals, I had it lats, working out the lats. You always think like, oh, it's a lot of arm work, which it is, but a lot of the pushing is just coming from your lat. So I had to do a lot of lats, glutes as well for brake pressure, because this car could just take so much brake pressure. I mean, when you hit the brake, you just come in and you just slam it as hard as you can. And the brakes like still just don't lock. Like they're amazing brakes. It's actually the first car I've gone into and haven't complained about braking performance. Every other car I've been in previously, I always struggled with brakes locking because I always would do too much pressure. But this car can take it. But yeah, other than that, glutes, lats, obviously shoulders and forearms and neck. But neck, you can be lazy on the neck if you want, because you could just put the pads. So you can just put more padding in and it'll hold you up.
And would you say, I can't remember exactly how Callum described this to me now, but I know that he kind of thought there were some like ovals versus road course, like some tracks were more like physical than others. So are there, I guess, first of all, how would you describe that? So for example, going on an oval, do you feel like you have to be more fit to deal with that versus a road course?
Honestly, I'd say ovals are easier than the road courses. But just throughout the way the season's been, I've just gotten far more in better shape than I did at the start of the season. Because I remember at the start of the season, every race I went to, it was like very tough. And throughout the season, it's just gotten easier and easier and easier until like Toronto. Toronto's normally one of the hardest races in the season, but for me, it still was quite easy relative to how the start of the season went. So my guess is that I've just physically gotten better. But in general, it tends to be that road course, street courses are the most physical for me. It goes street courses, road courses, and then ovals being the easiest.
I mean, in street courses in general, do you just feel like because of like the bumpy nature of the track instance or track surface and things like that, you just feel like you're physically wrestling the car a lot more around?
Exactly. A lot more wrestling. And then, if you try to get power down on these bumps, it always wants to kick the rear out. So you're trying to make sure that you don't, and you're gripping onto the wheel as hard as you can so you don't slide your hands and get blisters. Like it's a lot, you're just a lot more intense. Yeah, that's kind of the main thing with street courses.
And so do you feel that in some way IndyCar drivers might actually be a bit more skilled than F1 drivers since you guys need to drive on street tracks, road courses, and ovals?
Well, me being an IndyCar driver, I'm going to be biased and say, yeah, definitely. I mean, that'd probably be a good question for Callum, since he obviously made it to F2 over there. Of course, not F1, but he'd have a, I guess, a better information on it. But yeah, no, I mean, Yeah, they also have power steering over there. You know, we don't, and we also have a lot more variety of courses that we have to go to. So I'm gonna be biased and say, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, and like, I think sometimes the IndyCar versus F1 comparison, like it's you know they look similar, so it's a comparison that you want to make, but in some ways it is a bit apples to oranges. But I know one thing in the IndyCar offices we always talk a lot about is just the ovals, right? Because we say ovals, right? But then you have, you know, something like Iowa where we went to, it's like a much shorter oval. You have mid-size ovals. You have something in Indy, which is like a super speedway, right? And the way you approach it as a driver, you know, three, like the way you drove at Texas versus Iowa versus Indianapolis, right? Three different ways of approaching the track, right? So that's why, to me at least, I think learning a little bit more, I was like, gosh, that actually is like, there is a like good amount of variance between all these different tracks. So that probably has to be a lot to learn from a driver's side.
No, yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, every oval, Texas, Indy, and Iowa are very, very different and all have very different driving styles. And Iowa has two, almost three lanes, you know, with the way passes work and how you set them up. So yeah, all of them are very different.
Yeah, so maybe just to fixate in on like oval racing in particular a little bit, right? Because I think if you walk up to someone and just like ask them, what do you think about oval racing, right? In general, you're gonna get the like, oh, you just turn left. It's pretty simple, right? But you know, from an engineering point of view, from a driver's point of view, you know, then we just talked about the fact that there's variance between ovals. Can you kind of describe why like driving on an oval is not as simple as it may seem?
Well, ovals take a lot of brain fatigue. You know, it's normal, it's natural for a human brain to, you know, you're focusing on something. Let's say you're working in at the coffee shop and then you see a bird and you're like, oh, it's a bird. And then you just look at the bird for a couple seconds, you know, and lose track, which is normal for a human. But on an oval, when you're going, you know, 150 plus all the time and you're constantly like Iowa, there is no break. You're just constantly going into the next corner, into the next corner. And to do that for 250 laps or 300 laps, and to at the same time be setting up for passes, doing fuel map saves, you know, setting up your weight jackers, seeing how it's going to be when you're passing somebody or going underneath them. There's just so much to it that your brain just kind of gets overloaded. And then if you just split second, just for, like kind of, you know, do what a normal brain does and look at something else, and be like, oh, get lost. You all of a sudden have just, you know, you either made a big mistake or had a moment or of some sort. And that's to me where the hardest thing is from ovals is just brain fatigue and just making sure that you are paying attention to everything 24/7 and always staying focused as much as you can. So yeah, a lot of weird things for oval training is for me, it's been I actually play like Beat Saber, which is like, you know, to kind of make sure my reaction time is there. And I also do a lot of meditation to kind of have control over my thoughts and my brain. So in some ways to help with the oval. I don't know how accurate that is because this is just my own research, but that is in the way that I actually prepare going into ovals.
Yeah, and so that's interesting to me that so you meditate as well. So is that for you, is that like a big component of kind of like mentally training yourself for a race, not just ovals?
Yeah, exactly. When I meditate, it's just so when I have a training thought that comes through, you know, let's say I'm focusing on this and a thought comes by like, oh, what am I having for dinner? It's the meditation to me has helped to kind of catch on that, oh, I'm kind of losing focus here and kind of quickly get back to what I was doing. When I feel like before I meditated, it was you know, I think about what I wanted to eat for dinner for multiple minutes until I realized that, oh, what am I doing? I'm losing track.
Yeah, it's funny because this is even outside of the context of racing, this is kind of like an issue. I think it's just being behind the wheel, it's almost like a heightened issue, right? That you I think people talk about with like TikTok and stuff, like kids our age just like cannot focus for more than 10 seconds on anything, right? And then, you know, if I don't focus on like something for more than 10 seconds, I just end up wasting time. If you lose your focus behind the wheel of the car, that could be a pretty big deal, right? So, I mean,
Yeah.
that's interesting to see that kind of like the. This is probably not something that like a widespread approach, but I'm sure that's effective to some level.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I've been doing it and I think it's been working.
So as an engineer, this is something that I've started to ask drivers more in general. But how do you involve yourself on the technical side of things? Do you try to just have a surface level understanding of the engineering and instead focus more on your physical and mental training?
Yeah, I actually this is one of the things that I've always throughout my racing career have followed, and it's to have a full trust in my engineer. So Ross, who's my engineer for Dale Coyne for this season, I know of course you know the basic things and the basic premises of how everything is, but I don't really go in depth in all that stuff because I don't want to have knowledge of something and then Ross coming up like, hey, I think we're gonna do this, and then if I had that knowledge, I would just not like the feeling of, oh, I don't like that. I think we should do this. And obviously some drivers would say like, yes, that's a plus because it's more people. But for me, I feel like I should put all my trust in the engineer and to be, if I were to have to battle with him decision making, I definitely just wouldn't want that. So for that stuff, I tend to just kind of stray away from it and just give him the information and put the full trust on my engineer to give me the setup that I need.
And to some of that, and this is kind of like the trade-off with this question, this is the trade-off I usually think about, is the trade-off that yes, you want to understand what's going on to a certain extent, right? But as a driver sitting behind the wheel thinking like an engineer isn't always pertinent, right? You want to just be able to get in the car and drive, right? You don't want to have to like overthink these things, right? So for you, is that maybe like another consideration in the fact that you choose to maybe not focus on it so much?
Yeah, I could say that is a factor. You know, if let's say you make a change and then you're dwelling on that one change that's been made and you're always focusing on it throughout the session, it's almost like you've already created your own conclusion. You know, like let's say something that would create maybe more oversteer and you know about it, you're just gonna go out there. You're like, wow, it's just oversteering when maybe it really isn't, and you've already just created that conclusion. And any little moment that you get, you just add to it and you're very committed to it. So I could see by, yeah, I mean, that could also be partially the reason to it.
So essentially what you're saying is you kind of like to take like the STIG approach to it. You just get in whatever is there and you just drive as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I just give the feedback to my engineer, and they make the car depending on what feedback I give. And I try to give very detailed, informative feedback. You know, I don't just say like, oh yeah, it's understeering a little bit in, this corner. Yeah, I try to go more informative and give more information to them, so the decision that they make will be more of an accurate choice. But yeah, once I get in the car, I kind of just, especially if it's a race, I just get in it, and if whatever it is, I just have to deal with it and adapt my driving to it.
When you first get out on track for a practice session, what exactly is the process of combing through parameters like ride height or aero bounds to get to an optimal setup? Like what is, I guess, what are those like first considerations when you get out on the track and then in a new circuit? Like these are the one or two things we just need to kind of get these down first and foremost.
Oh, well, it's always different. Every race we go to, it really just depends on what Ross the engineer, what his goals are. He'll always tell, we always kind of do a pre-run plan of before the practice comes in, and he'll give me, things that we want to try going into it and make sure that they're in the right place before, we move on to other things or going into the next practice. And a lot of it is already, kind of pre-planned. And yeah, while you're on track, maybe a few things will change here and there. But because the practice sessions are short in the grand scheme of things, and only having two of them, it's everything's just kind of pre-planned when we talk about it, and we try to get all those things done.
Now you were speaking about this a little bit before, right? With talking about how you like the car to be set up a bit like an Indy Lights car. But in general, do you have a certain preference when it comes to setting up overall car balance? Like I'm assuming now based on your Indy Lights comparison, do you like the car to be a bit oversteery?
Yes, definitely. I mean, of course, you don't want the thing to be on rails and on ice skates, and anytime you go into a corner, you're just, it's just very scared that the thing might just spin out at any second. But I just feel like there's more control from a driver's standpoint, that if the car is a little bit on the slidey end, I feel like you can, still control it through a corner. When with understeer, there's not much you can do. You kind of just have to sit and wait for the car to, to make it out of the corner. Of course, there's different things that you can do by, releasing the brake and just carrying more just natural speed into the corner, and just so braking a bit deeper and just letting the car roll to help with that understeer, so you're not going in so slow and then just waiting on the tire even more. But I just feel like, if you have the oversteer, you can just still carry that much more speed. And if it's a bit on the slidey end, the driver can counter it.
Yeah. I mean, based on my understanding, and like you can tell me whether this is like the wrong way to think about it, but my understanding has always kind of been that understeer is a bit more predictable. But obviously, like you're saying, it's maybe a little bit harder to negate. Like really, probably the best solution is you enter the corner a bit slower, which is obviously not the fastest solution, right? Whereas oversteer, you could probably get through a corner a little bit quicker, but to your point again, if the car is a lot more unstable, there is more of a chance that you're going to lose control of the car, right? So is that, do you think you're playing a bit more of a high risk game by driving an oversteery car?
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what it is. You know, when it's understeer, it's very predictable. You know exactly what it's doing, and it's very, you know, but there's a lot more speed to find if the car's a bit on the oversteer end and you can control it. But yeah, you're always gonna be kind of on that risk, you know, that you might lose control of the car, or it's always gonna be on edge. And even if you have like a big slide of a moment, you know, in a race for one tire stint, that one slide, you know, that just lost quite a bit of token on that tire. And now it's obviously much more worn out, and you might not be able to make your full stint. But, you know, through Indy Lights and just kind of the general feeling of what I had through my open wheel racing career, I've always been more on the oversteer end. So through this much time and being in IndyCar, I feel like I can, as a driver, be good enough to control it.
And is this still something that an approach that you would apply for the ovals as well? Because I would imagine, again, from a purely from an engineering point of view, you probably want a more neutral car. Like, for example, when we were in Iowa this week, right?
Yeah, so with ovals, it's always a bit different, because in ovals it's actually a little bit on the opposite, and you want it to be, I mean, the whole goal is just be perfect, like neutral, right? Like no understeer, no oversteer, it's kind of just right where you need it to be. But if you were to have a preference on an oval, you definitely want to be a little bit on the understeer end, because oversteer on an oval is extremely scary. And if you have a big moment, most of the time it is a very slim chance that you will be able to save it. And you also just affect the rear tires that much more, and it just gets tougher and tougher as the stint goes on. And that definitely goes into account at Indy. You know, you always want to be a little bit more on the understeer. And the whole saying is that if it slides in Indy, you have to just pit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of the approach in Iowa a little bit this weekend too, right? The second you start losing time, the car is uncontrollable, just immediately dive into the pits. I guess now that I do think about it, thinking back to the 500 this year too, I think probably what four or five of those crashes exactly was, the rear end kind of snapping out of line. So I definitely understand that point of view that you would, just for a safety factor, you would rather bias to understeer versus oversteer.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and like I said, it all just comes down to understeer is much more predictable. You know that it's just, if it's scrubbing a little bit, especially on an oval, you just have to lift, which is unfortunate. You're going to lose more, a little bit of speed there, but at least you're not going into a wall.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So at 20 years old, you probably have a much more interesting and exciting life than most people out there. So at this moment in time, what is it that motivates you? I mean, I'm sure with now reaching the top rung of IndyCar, there's been some level of satisfaction, but how do you prevent yourself from just being content with your current situation and actually continue to push yourself to a higher level of performance?
Well, I am very competitive, and you know, although I have achieved many goals this season and last season, I mean, the whole goal is to become a championship contender in IndyCar and win many races and have a championship in there and a 500 win. So, and those goals are still very far out, because the IndyCar talent pool is just insane. I mean, like for qualifying, just, you know, the couple laps that you do, I am much more exhausted than in the race, because that's how hard you have to push the car to compete with all these drivers, because they're just pushing it to the limit. So yeah, I mean, I will always stay motivated, you know, for those goals. I mean, if those goals end up being achieved, which, you know, which would be a miracle and amazing. You know, I think from that end, I don't know. I am very competitive, so I still feel like I'll create another goal that I want to be the first driver to achieve this or this. And I just feel like it's always going to be there, just having that competitive mentality. And anytime you have, you know, a bad race, like St. Pete, for example, you know, the first race into the season, I go in and had a crash, and it was just like the worst way to start off a season. And I was really beating myself up for it, which I know normally you're not supposed to do that. But for me, it's just made me go into the gym that much more, maybe go in the sim that much more, and to really try my absolute hardest to, you know, make sure I bounce back and get to where I need to be to achieve my goals.
The older I've got, I've started to hear the term work-life balance a lot more. And as a driver, obviously, racing has been a big part of your life from a young age. So firstly, do you feel that you have a balanced personality and lifestyle? And secondarily, do you feel that racing or being a race driver is how you define yourself?
Yeah, for the second question, I definitely yeah, that is how I identify as myself. But yeah, for the life balance, yeah, it's I'd say for this season probably not, because it is my first season in IndyCar and it is a busy schedule. So there's a lot of new things and all this back-to-back-to-back racing. It's I have yeah, let's just say I haven't really seen a lot of my family in quite some time, and missed many different events. But I think once, a couple more seasons, and once I get used to it and kind of learn a bit of a schedule, then, I think there'll be balance there. But right now, it's that balance has been a little bit shifted, more towards just the racing end. But, I don't mind it, because, this has been something I've dreamed of since I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, my final question for today, what is an immediate goal you have for the remainder of this season or the next? And what do you need to do in order to achieve it?
Well, the goal for this season, which would be spectacular for me, would just be get top 10 finishes for the rest of the races. If we can stay consistent and get these top 10 finishes, I think that'll be enough for us to get the rookie championship. And also, just from our end, just be, because in this top 10, I mean, everybody's just so competitive and so skilled, and there's all these big teams that are in those top 10s, and if we can still keep getting these results, I'll be very happy from my end.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on to the show today, David. I wish you the best of luck for the rest of the season, and hopefully I'll run into you at Indy Road Course this weekend.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, and I'll see you then.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Chasing the Apex. I hope you found David to be an interesting guest. Having spent the past couple of months interning at IndyCar, I had plenty of questions for David and was glad I got a chance to speak with him. If you like this episode, make sure to follow me at ctp.motorsport on Instagram and at SidTalksF1 on TikTok. Thanks again.